air defenses intercept missiles fired by Israel on the western province of Hama. Millions of Americans were faced with a Christmas nightmare as a political fight between President Donald Trump and Congress leaves the government spending package in limbo. And Iran says the U.S. President Donald Trump will be responsible for any adventurism after he blamed Tehran for a rocket attack on the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. Welcome everyone to the World News Bulletin. Now, Syria says its air defenses have repelled an act of Israeli aggression in the west of the country. Syrian Defense Ministry said Israeli aircraft targeted the Masyaf area in the Hama countryside, but most of the missiles were intercepted. It added the attack was launched from the northern Lebanese city of Tripoli. Syrian TV aired footage showing air defenses responding to the Israeli attack. Israel frequently conducts air raids against positions inside war-ravaged Syria. Attacks are seen as a reaction to the Syrian forces' success in battling foreign-backed terror groups seeking to topple the government of President Bashar al-Assad. Joining us out of Hamilton, Ontario, is Ken Stone from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. Hello, Ken. Now, Ken, we see this. The frequency is just mind-boggling. Once or twice a week, we see Israel with no UN mandate, with no permission, carry out raids on Syrian soil. Help us put that into perspective or make some kind of sense out of it.
Well, all these Israeli attacks on the sovereign country of Syria are completely illegal. They're in violation of many, they're in violation of international law and the Charter of the United Nations. But that doesn't stop the Israelis from going ahead and continuing to bomb Syria while it is under an attack by a U.S.-led coalition of which Canada, unfortunately, is a part. The bad news here is that for about the 1,000th time, Israel is conducting one of these illegal operations against Syria and trying to deliver an unwelcome Christmas gift on the eve of Christmas to the Syrians and to the Christians in Syria. The good news is that the Syrian government was able to foil the attack and repel the assault, this illegal assault on its sovereign territory. And it shows that Syria is becoming more and more strong and resilient and able to defend itself against the Zionist aggressor. There are many countries that can't. For example, Lebanon. Lebanon's airspace is violated on almost a daily basis by the Israeli government. But Syria, thanks to the help from its allies, such as Russia and Iran, is able to have the technological capability to withstand and repel these attacks. We have to remember that Israel is part of the U.S.-led coalition waging a war on Syria, an illegal war, in which the U.S. and Canada and many other Western countries put terrorists into the country to try and force a regime change, and that failed. And there's only one province left, Idlib, where the terrorists are still holding sway. And the U.S. is also illegally occupying the entire eastern third of Syria with the help of their proxies in the SDF. And they are sitting on top of Syria's petroleum resources precisely in order that the resurgent Syrian government does not have the resources available for reconstruction. So Israel is part of the game, part of the regime change game. They are failing. They are still lashing out, like the U.S., which is still sitting on Syrian oil. But the fact is that the Syrian government is going to win. It's going to retake every square inch of Syrian territory, as President Assad has said these long 9 years so far. And there will be a reckoning with the state of Israel. They will have to pay for all the crimes that they've committed against their Syrian neighbor, including the restoration of the Golan Heights, which is part of the sovereign country of Syria.
Always a pleasure and a blessing to have you on the program. Merry Christmas and talk to you soon, Ken. Thanks for joining us from Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. That was Ken Stone from the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. Meanwhile, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has condemned the normalization deals between some Arab states and Israel, calling them a treacherous stab in the back of Palestinians. In a letter addressing heads of 30 Arab states and Arab and Islamic states, that is, Ismail Haniyeh, head of the political bureau of Hamas, described normalization deals as a major political sin, adding that the deals have emboldened the Israeli regime to intensify its aggression against Palestine. This month, Morocco became the fourth Arab country to sign a normalization deal with the regime. UAE, Bahrain, and Sudan had earlier signed similar deals. All Palestinian factions have repudiated the normalization accords, considering them a betrayal of the Palestinian cause. Author and journalist Eric Wahlberg says normalization deals between some Arab states and Israel are a betrayal to Palestinians and Islam.
Well, this is a betrayal of not just the Palestinians, but to Islam. You know, it's clear that Israel is in violation, and its crimes are just mounting. Its Judaization of Jerusalem, its settlements, its daily, almost daily killing, murdering of Palestinians. So it's very sad to see, but the Emirates is one thing. They're a puppet, they're not really the Arab world, but it's sad to see Morocco, although Morocco was power politics to get the Western Sahara recognized as Moroccan.
Palestinians in Gaza have held a protest against a UN decision to reduce aid services in the impoverished enclave. They say the reduction has negatively impacted daily lives amid an Israeli blockade and the coronavirus pandemic. Ruba Shabit has your story.
The Palestinian Refugees Committee in the Gaza Strip organized a rally against the UN AIDS and Health Services reduction. Palestinian refugees who have impacted badly by this reduction participated in the demonstration, calling for the world body's attention to the dire condition in the impoverished enclave.
It's our right to get the UN's aid services. People here are living in a deteriorating condition amid the pandemic. People here can't afford living, and now, with the reduction of the UN aid services, their life is getting even worse.
Palestinians believe the reduction in aid services by the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, is an attempt by the U.S. to liquidate the humanitarian organization. Earlier, the U.S. announced plans to withhold $65 million of aid to the UNRWA until further notice.
The UN aid services reduction will have dire consequences as it deprives the Palestinian refugees from their basic rights. The reduction comes amid a critical political time as Israel is stepping up its pressure on the Palestinians.
By reducing the refugees' aid, the UN is standing beside the Israeli occupation at the expense of Palestinians' rights. We are calling for our rights, and the UN should fulfill its commitments.
The demonstrators call on the international community to reverse the reduction decision by the UN and keep on supporting the Palestinian refugees who have lost their lands and were expelled since 1948.
The reduction policy aims at reducing the aid services step by step until Palestinians are completely deprived of their rights. The UNRWA was established to help and support Palestinian refugees. The reduction policies serve Israel's interests.
UNRWA was established to aid the 700,000 Palestinians who were expelled from their homes during the war surrounding Israeli occupation's establishment in 1948. More than the half of the 2 million people in the Gaza Strip are dependent on support from UNRWA, and depriving them from the services they need will worsen the living conditions. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Now the fate of a U.S. coronavirus relief package hangs in the balance after Democrats and Republicans blocked each other's attempts to amend it. Democrats in the House of Representatives blocked Republican attempts to cut foreign aid from the federal spending bill, while Republicans refused to allow an increase in coronavirus payments to $2,000 to Americans. President Donald Trump had demanded changes after Congress passed a $900 billion emergency economic relief package on Monday. A failure to pass the package threatens the livelihoods of tens of millions of Americans and broader U.S. economy. Unemployment benefits for 14 million Americans expire Saturday. Stimulus is attached to a broader funding package, so Americans also face the prospects of a government shutdown during the pandemic if parties cannot reach a consensus. Political commentator Frank M. Spack says the U.S. president wants to unleash chaos and blame everyone else for it.
He can do nothing and let it die, and then everything has to start all over again, including the budget negotiations. The government gets shut down, and there's no relief. That happens after January 3rd. Or he vetoes it, which he has not said he's going to do, and then they would see if there's an override. I don't think there's the votes for that. Or there is a modification of the bill, which seems to be very, very difficult to do. I think he's going to posture until the last moment and then sign it reluctantly. But he may not. So I don't think anybody really knows exactly what's going to happen. What are the consequences? Maybe he's crazy like a fox, you see, and says he's going to blame everybody, leave the White House, and then run on the basis that these people can't do anything and are horrible people. And I wanted $2,000 and these guys prevented it.
COVID-19 still rages in the Americas region despite the government's efforts to contain the pandemic. Brazil recorded more than 58,000 new cases of the coronavirus, bringing a total number of infected to 7.4 million. The country also logged over 760 new deaths, taking the total death toll to almost 190,000. Elsewhere in the region, the United States reported over 3,400 new deaths and more than 221,000 daily cases. The U.S. remains the world's hardest hit country by the pandemic, with over 18.6 million infections and more than 328,000 fatalities, and that's despite Washington's efforts to speed up vaccination efforts. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has reacted to U.S. President Donald Trump's latest accusations against Tehran. In a tweet, Zarif criticized Trump for using a worthless photo to blame Iran for recent attacks on the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. He said the outgoing U.S. president will be responsible for any adventurism in the region. Now, this comes after Trump accused Iran of being behind Sunday's strike on Washington's Baghdad embassy, saying he'll hold Tehran responsible should any American die. Earlier, his Secretary of State Mike Pompeo made similar remarks, blaming what he called Iranian-backed groups for the attack. Now, Iran has dismissed the accusations as irresponsible and false claims aimed at instigating tensions. Political commentator John Pfeffer believes the outgoing U.S. president constantly denies reality and never sticks to facts to justify his actions.
Well, the Trump administration, in its final month in office, is determined to make sure that the Biden administration, the incoming Biden administration, has a hard time to bring the United States back into the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. And this is a part of that initiative, shall we say, of the Trump administration. We could call it the Scorched Earth Initiative. In other words, to destroy as much as possible in terms of foreign policy and domestic policy before the Biden administration takes office. Well, the Trump administration has never needed facts, of course, to justify any of its actions. It has, as you see, denied the reality of the last election here in the United States, denied the reality of COVID-19 and its impact here in the United States, denied the reality of climate change. So, of course, the Trump administration doesn't feel like it has to adhere to any set of facts.
UK and European Union have finally secured an agreement over their future ties, setting the seal on Britain's referendum decision to leave the bloc. Bianca Rahimi has more.
Christmas Eve 2020, Prime Minister Boris Johnson signed off on an historic post-Brexit trade and security agreement with the European Union after an intense 24-hour negotiation period. A press conference expected early in the day finally came in the afternoon after lawyers and translators had crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's.
I'm very pleased to tell you this afternoon that we have completed the biggest trade deal yet, worth £660 billion. A year, a comprehensive Canada-style free trade deal between the UK and the EU, a deal that will protect jobs across this country, a deal that will allow goods, UK goods and components to be sold without tariffs and without quotas in the EU market, a deal which will, if anything, allow our companies and our exporters to do even more business with our European friends.
A deal will mean Britain finally leaving the bloc's single market and customs union in a week, and freedom of movement will end. It also settles the future arrangements on a vast range of issues, from aviation and transport to civil nuclear cooperation and energy. The sticking points that took Brexit to the brink of no deal was access to British fishing waters, a contentious issue that prompted the UK to send Navy ships to the English Channel in case of clashes, and the level playing field, which is an important part of the EU single market, allowing for fair and open competition. The negotiations were very difficult, with lots at stake for many, and it was an agreement worth fighting for. It will allow us to avoid major disruptions to workers, businesses and travellers after January 1st. It will protect European interests, and this agreement is also, I believe, in the interests of the United Kingdom. It will lay solid foundations for a new start with long-time friends, and finally, it will ensure we can leave Brexit behind us. Europe continues to move forward. Despite the collective sighs of relief and resignation across Britain, the devil is in the detail. French media made waves in the hours leading up to it by asserting the UK had made huge concessions, something Westminster was quick to deny. Hardline Tory Brexiteers from the European Research Group have said its star chamber of lawyers will be convened to analyse the proposed agreement, suggesting it's not over yet. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Rebel groups in the Central African Republic have declared a three-day ceasefire in the run-up to the 27th of December legislative and presidential elections. Coalition called on the government to similarly observe a truce over the same period and urged President Faustin Archange Touadéra to suspend the elections. They also accused the president of attempting to fix the vote. Over the weekend, the government accused of former President Francois Bozize of plotting a coup with the help of the rebels. Meanwhile, the UN has brought troops to the African country to help secure and monitor the elections. Elections are considered a key test of the conflict-torn nation's ability to regain stability. And reactions are pouring in after Britain and European Union finally struck a post-Brexit trade and security deal following marathon negotiations. German Chancellor Angela Merkel said she's confident the deal is a very good outcome. French President Emmanuel Macron welcomed the agreement as well, saying that unity and firmness of EU members has paid off. Former British Premiers David Cameron and Theresa May called the news very welcome. Irish Prime Minister Michael Martin hailed the deal as a good compromise, saying it's, quote, the least bad version of Brexit possible for his country. Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon, though, strongly slammed the deal, saying it's against the will of her people, and she said the agreement is disastrous for Scottish farmers. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. A study published in the journal Atmosphere analyzed data collected every few minutes from pollution monitors in people's homes and in total assessed 260 uses of wood burners. The results showed the burners were usually lit for about 4 hours at a time, and during this period the level of harmful particles in homes was 3 times higher than when stoves were not being used. During those 4 hours, average particle levels rose to between 27 and 195 micrograms per cubic meter of air. The World Health Organization, WHO, limit is 25 micrograms per meter cubed over 24 hours. The researchers wrote, "Epidemiologists are increasingly recognizing that exposure to high intensities of small particles over much shorter periods of time, hours rather than days, is linked to a range of health issues. They concluded it is recommended that the new residential stoves be accompanied by a health warning at the point of sale in order to indicate the health risks posed to users. The scientists said government approval schemes should also assess indoor pollution. Higher outdoor air pollution and cooking fumes were ruled out as causes of the indoor peaks. The particles are the most harmful pollutants in wood smoke, but it also contains carcinogenic chemicals including benzene and formaldehyde. We're prepared for you an article written by Damien Carinto under the heading "Study Finds Wood Burners 3 times Harmful at Indoor Air Pollution." The article has appeared on the front page of the Guardian.com website. Please stay with us for more of Damien Carinto's article. Scientists said wood burners triple the level of harmful pollution particles inside homes and should be sold with a health warning, also advising that they should not be used around elderly people or children. A study found that tiny particles flood into the room when the wood burner doors are opened for refueling. Furthermore, people who load in wood twice or more in an evening are expected to pollution spikes 2 or 4 times higher than those who refuel once or not at all. The particles can pass through the lungs and into the body and have been linked to a wide range of health damage, particularly in younger and older people. The research was conducted in 19 homes in Sheffield, England, over the course of a month at the start of 2020. The wood burners used were all models certified by the government as smoke-exempt appliances, meaning they produce less smoke. But this and the new eco-design standard, due to become compulsory by 2022, only assess outdoor pollution. The British government is phasing out the sale of wet wood, which produces more smoke, but the people in the study used only dry, seasoned wood. Wood and coal burning in homes is estimated to cause almost 40% of outdoor tiny particle pollution. By the new research is among the first to analyze indoor pollution in real-life settings. According to 2016 government data, almost 16% of people in the southeast of England use wood fuel, and 18% in Northern Ireland, and about 175,000 wood burners are sold annually. Rohit Chakraborty from the University of Sheffield, who led the study, said, "Our findings are a cause for concern," adding, "It is recommended that people living with those particularly susceptible to air pollution, such as children, the elderly, or the vulnerable, avoid using wood-burning stoves. If people want to use them, we recommend minimizing the time the stove is open during lighting or refueling. Rohit Chakrabarty from the University of Sheffield said wood burners cause less indoor pollution than open fires. But every time you open a door, they reduce the stove to an open fire and particulate matter floods into the home. The peaks take an hour or two to dissipate, Chakrabarty said. But by the time it comes down, someone opens the door again to refuel and you get spike after spike. Some burners have filters, but these only reduce the pollution being vented outside. Some people outside central heating rely on wood burners for heating of their home, and Chakrabarty did not call for a ban. He said, "We should leave it to people to decide, but they should at least know what's going on, and of course, don't use it if you don't need to." The study published in the journal Atmosphere analyzed data collected every few minutes from pollution monitors in people's homes and in total assessed 260 uses of wood burners. The results showed the burners were usually lit for about 4 hours at a time, and during this period the level of harmful particles in homes was 3 times higher than when stoves were not being used. During those 4 hours, average particle levels rose to between 27 and 195 micrograms per cubic meter of air. The World Health Organization limit is 25 micrograms per meter cube of air over 24 hours. The researchers wrote, epidemiologists are increasingly recognizing that exposure to high intensities of small particles over much shorter periods of time, hours rather than days, is linked to a range of health issues. They concluded, it is recommended that new residential stoves be accompanied by a health warning at the point of sale in order to indicate the health risks posed to users. The scientists said government approval schemes should also assess indoor pollution. Higher outdoor air pollution and cooking fumes were ruled out as causes of the indoor peaks. The particles are the most harmful pollutants in wood smoke, but it also contains carcinogenic chemicals including benzene and formaldehyde. James Hayden of the University of Nottingham, who was part of the study team, said, "Instead of being seen as a harmful appliance, wood-burning stoves should be recognized as having the potential for harm." He added, "Most of our participants were unaware of this, and more needs to be done to raise awareness of the health risks." 3 of the households in the study stopped using their burners after seeing their results, and another 12 took action such as refueling faster or less often, or ensuring the wood was really dry. Professor Jonathan Grigg of Queen Mary College, University of London, who led a recent report on the health effects of indoor air pollution on children for the Royal College of Physicians and Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health, said, "There is no reason to believe that particulate matter from wood-burning stoves is less toxic than that from other sources, such as combustion of fossil fuels." He said, "This study confirms that indoor wood burners contribute significantly to indoor air pollution." He added, "It also suggests that even government-certified solid fuel stoves impair local outdoor air quality. It is therefore difficult to justify their use in any urban area." A spokeswoman for the UK's Department of the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs claimed, "Air pollution has reduced significantly in recent years, with emissions of fine particulate matter falling 9% in the last decade. But we know there is more to do, and domestic burning is a major contributor." The spokesman for the UK Department of Environment said, The forthcoming environment bill would make it easier for local authorities to enforce existing restrictions within smoke control areas. Ministers are not planning a ban on wood burners.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين أجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف وجعلنا من أعوانه وأنصاره. Last night we talked about a very important dimension of balance that must exist in every person and in our community. And that is the balance that we should strike between being emotional and being rational. We need to have both, and if we lose one of them or if we overdo one of them, then it creates problems. I mentioned two hadith about the significance of having a kind of emotional unity or connection or link with Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And now I'm going to share with you the third hadith, which leads us to another characteristic of the community, and that is truthfulness. Amirul Mu'mineen alayhi as-salam, in a famous hadith, said, إن الله تبارك وتعالى أطلع إلى الأرض فاختارنا واختار لنا شيعة. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala looked at the earth, looked at the people, and among them he chose us. And he chose for us some Shia, some followers. ينصروننا. These are the people that help us. These are the people that work for achieving our goals. وَيَفْرَحُونَ لِفَرَحَنَا وَيَحْزَنُونَ لِحُزْنَنَا. They are not just like some robots, or you know, just some people who are paid to work for you. You know, sometimes you may be working for a boss, you don't have any kind of a spiritual, psychological connection to your boss. Maybe even you hate your boss, but still you work for him. But wilaya is not like this. Wilaya is that you follow, you obey because you love your Mullah. So the reason for obedience is love, which is by itself generated by ma'rifah. When you know how good your Mullah is, you love him, and because you love him, you want to do something to make him happy. Even sometimes maybe he hasn't asked you anything, but you look for, you know, some opportunity to do something to make him happy. So ينصرونا ويفرحون لفرحنا ويحزنون لحزننا. When we are happy, they are happy. When we are sad, they are sad. This is also by itself a balance, that we should not only remember Ahlul Bayt in happy occasions or only in sad occasions. We must not be the Shia who only cry or who only smile and laugh and, you know, celebrate. We should commemorate both types of occasions that, alhamdulillah, our community, of course, does this. وَيَبْذُلُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ وَأَنفُسَهُمْ فِينا. They spend their money and they spend their own lives, their own time, their own selves for our sake. فِينا. يَبْذُلُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ وَأَنفُسَهُمْ فِينا. Not lana. It's not that they spend their money for us. This is not enough. Fina, for our sake. Because today, maybe there is no way to spend your money, you know, for Amirul Mu'minin alayhi salam. But you have to understand, you have to be clever. What would Amirul Mu'minin expect from you today? If a Shia of Ali is in trouble and I help him, I am spending money fi Amir al-Mu'minin, means for the sake of Amir al-Mu'minin. If I am doing something to spread the teachings of Amir al-Mu'minin, I am spending money fi Amir al-Mu'minin. Not necessarily le Amir al-Mu'minin. Maybe Ali is not here, or Ali is the richest person, he doesn't need my money. But anything that I do in order to make him happy, that is counted as badlul mal fi.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here, who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
So يَبْذُلُونَ أَمْوَالَهُمْ وَأَنفُسَهُمْ فِينَا. Their money, but also their life. They are ready to give their life for our sake. It's not just a matter of money. Of course, for some people, to give life is easier than giving money. But for some people, it's opposite. أُولَٰئِكَ مِنَّا وَإِلَيْنَا. They are from us, and they join us in future. It's very beautiful. أُولَٰئِكَ مِنَّا. They come from us. You know this hadith that Shi'atuna khulqu min fadlatinatina. Our Shia are created from the extra clay from which we are created. Of course, the discussion about a hadith which relate to Tina needs time. Maybe sometime, inshallah, we explain that this is not in the sense that because of the material from which we are created, we have become Shia. That has another explanation. It has nothing to do with kind of predestination. But there is a kind of similarity between our creation and their creation, which in my understanding of these ahadith, that similarity is built by our own behavior. Inshallah, maybe sometime I explain this. In any way, there is some kind of similarity between us and Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, and we hope that inshallah this would end by joining them in the hereafter. We don't want to be far from them on the day of judgment or afterwards. We want to be with them. As we say in Ziyarat Ashura, very beautifully, أسأل الله الذي أكرمني بمعرفتكم ومعرفة أوليائكم ورزقني البراءة من أعدائكم أن يجعلني معكم في الدنيا والآخرة. I want to be with you in dunya, I want to be with you in akhirah. To be with them in dunya is to work for them, to be part of their community, part of their team, to feel that you have to answer to them. And then to be with them in akhirah means to be on the day of judgment able to stand behind them. يَوْمَ نَدْعُوا كُلَّ أُنَاسٍ بِإِمَامِهِمْ. When Allah asks every group of people to stand before their imam and their leaders, we should be able to prove that this man was the one that I was following. This is the person that my life was dedicated to obeying him. So in dunya we can be with them, and then inshallah based on that in akhirah. So ulaika minna wa ilayna.
I'm looking back throughout the years to breathe is hard and my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
Oh Allah, please send your salutations to Muhammad and all Muhammad. Oh Allah, please forgive us. Please forgive all our sins and mistakes and shortcomings. Please enable us to serve you with full honesty and truthfulness and sincerity. Please include us among the best followers of Muhammad and Al Muhammad. Please protect and safeguard our community and our families and our youths from everything that you don't like. O Allah, please hasten the reappearance of Imam Zaman Ajjalallah Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. Please make our Imam Zaman happy with what we do and what we say. Please answer his du'as for his faraj. Please give shifa to all people who are ill. Please give shifa to people who are ill in their body and in their soul. O Allah, please send your rahmah, your forgiveness to all who have passed away, especially brothers and sisters who were attending these majalis in this community and other communities. Our parents, our foreparents, our teachers, our ulama, our maraji, those who have passed away. Please let them be with Muhammad and Ali Muhammad right now. And please give long life and blessed life to the parents and to the teachers and maraji who are alive. Oh Allah, please make the last moment of our life the best moment of our life. Wa akhiru da'wana and alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
My ummah, he will say, Rasulullah on that day. Even though we've strayed from him and his way. My brothers, my sisters in Islam, let's struggle, work and pray. If we are to bring back the glory of his way. Ya Allah, يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the ummah rise again.
يا الله
يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
In the limelight.
Much of California has exhausted its usual ability to staff intensive care beds for treating coronavirus patients, and US's most populated state is desperately searching for 3,000 temporary medical workers to meet demand. State officials are reaching out to foreign partners in places like Australia and Taiwan amid a shortage of temporary medical workers in the United States, particularly nurses trained in critical care. Dr. Janet Kaufman, a professor of public policy at the University of California, San Francisco, said, "We're now in a situation where we have surges all across the country, so nobody has many nurses to spare." California hospitals typically turn to staffing agencies during flu season, when they rely on travel nurses to meet patient care needs. For example, it is the only state in the United States with strict nurse-to-patient ratios, requiring hospitals to provide one nurse for every two patients in intensive care and one nurse for every four patients in emergency rooms. However, those ratio requirements are being waived at many hospitals in California as the coronavirus cases surge. But according to San Diego-based healthcare staffing from Aya Healthcare, the pool of available travel nurses is drying up as demand for them jumped to 44% over the last month, with California, Texas, Florida, New York, and Minnesota requesting the most extra staff. Stay with us for an article written by Daisy Nguyen and Don Thompson. The piece is titled, "California Desperately Searches for More Nurses and Doctors." The article was published by the Associated Press News Agency. Since the coronavirus pandemic took hold in the United States, Sarah Howes has been on the road, going from one hospital to another to care for COVID-19 patients on the brink of death. A cardiac intensive care nurse from Washington, D.C., with expertise in heart rhythm, airwave, and pain management, her skills are in great demand as infections and hospitalizations skyrocket nationwide. Sarah Howes is among more than 500 nurses, doctors, and other medical staff California has brought in and deployed to hospitals that are running out of capacity to treat the most severe COVID-19 cases. Her six-week assignment started on Monday, 21st of December, in San Bernardino, about 60 miles east of Los Angeles, and she anticipates working 14-hour shifts with a higher-than-usual caseload. San Bernardino County has 1,545 people in hospital, and more than 125 are in makeshift surge beds, which are being used because regular hospital space isn't available. Sarah Howes said, "I expect patients to die. That's been my experience. They die, I put them in body bags, the room gets cleaned, and then another patient comes in." Much of California has exhausted its usual ability to staff intensive care beds, and the nation's most populated state is desperately searching for 3,000 temporary medical workers to meet demand. California state officials are reaching out to foreign partners like in places like Australia and Taiwan amid a shortage of temporary medical workers in the United States, particularly nurses trained in critical care. California's governor, Gavin Newsom, said the state has relationships with countries that provide aid during crises such as wildfires. Dr. Janet Kaufman, a professor of public policy at the University of California, San Francisco, said, "We're now in a situation where we have surges all across the country, so nobody has many nurses to spare." California hospitals typically turn to staffing agencies during flu season when they rely on travel nurses to meet patient care. For example, it is the only state in the United States with strict nurse-to-patient ratios, requiring hospitals to provide one nurse for every two patients in intensive care and one nurse for every four patients in emergency rooms. However, those ratio requirements are being waived at many California hospitals as coronavirus cases surge. But according to San Diego-based healthcare staffing firm Aya Healthcare, the pool of available travel nurses is drying up as demand for them jumped to 44% over the last month, with California, Texas, Florida, New York, and Minnesota requesting the most extra staff. Aya Healthcare is one of two companies contracted by California to fulfill hospital staffing requests. Sophia Morris, Vice President of Account Management at Aya Healthcare, said, "We are hiring like crazy and working insane hours." Dr. Mark Galli, California's Health and Human Services Secretary, said the state is getting 2/3 of its requests for travel nurses fulfilled right now. It's a sharp contrast from the spring, where Governor Newsom ordered the nation's first stay-at-home order. As infection rates slowed and hospitals voluntarily suspended elective surgeries for weeks, healthcare providers from California flew to New York to help their overworked colleagues. Jan Emerson Shear, a spokeswoman for the California Hospital Association, said this time many hospitals are postponing procedures that are not emergencies. California also has opened alternative care facilities for people with less serious illnesses to save hospital beds for the sickest patients. Dr. Kaufman said that also means hospitals have fewer nurses to deploy to intensive care units from other units, adding, "And many healthcare workers became infected or have had to quarantine because they were exposed to someone with COVID-19 during the surge." Another factor is a dip in the number of nurses 60 years old and older. Joanne Spetz, the University of California, San Francisco's Health Force Center Associate Director of Research, said in a survey of the state's 320,000 registered nurses, many older nurses told researchers at the center that they stopped working out of concern for their or their own family's health. Sarah House, a 50-year-old, said she's able to travel to work because her twin sons are in college, but not without contracting a mild case of COVID-19 somewhere along the way. On Monday, 21st of December, more than 17,000 people were hospitalized with confirmed COVID-19 infections, more than double the previous peak reached in July, an estate model that uses current data to forecast future trends shows the number could reach nearly 100,000 by January. More than 3,600 COVID-19 patients were in intensive care units. Dr. Mark Futernick, an emergency room physician in Los Angeles, who is on the board of the California chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians, helped set up a Los Angeles surge hospital last spring. Now he's fielding texts and phone calls asking when it will reopen. He said, "The surge hospital is not going to open again. There would be no way to staff it." Dr. Mark Galli, head of the California State Health and Human Services, said entire areas of California may run out of room, even in surge capacity units, by the end of the month and early in January. It's trying to avoid that by opening makeshift hospitals in places like gymnasiums, in tents, and a vacant NBA arena, and sending patients to parts of the state with empty beds. California's Governor Gavin Newsom this spring sought to reinforce fatigued medical workers by creating a paid volunteer California Health Corps, and he touted the many thousands who signed up. But with cases skyrocketing now, just 28 members are working at 13 facilities. The number has dwindled even after California Governor Gavin Newsom made repeated appeals for more retired medical professionals to sign up. The state is updating its planning guide for how hospitals would ration care if everyone can't get the treatment that they need. A document recently circulated among doctors at the four hospitals run by Los Angeles County calls for them to shift strategy. Instead of trying everything to save a life, their goal during the crisis is to save as many patients as possible. That means those less likely to survive won't get the same kind of care offered in normal times. Sarah Howe said her online community of nurses is offering webinars about moral distress because many of them have had to change the way they care for patients. She said, "The patients that aren't yet intubated, and even the ones intubated, aren't getting the kind of nursing care that I want to give them because our resources are so limited and time is taxed." She added, "It's really disheartening."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.